Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Judith Brown, senior attorney with the Advancement Project, who reports on the continuing investigation into allegations of voter intimidation and disenfranchisement related to race and ethnicity in Florida. Peter Kornbluh with the National Security Archive, who summarizes information contained in the latest release of secret government documents revealing the U.S. role in the 1973 military overthrow of Chile's democratically elected government. And Michael Dolan, Deputy Director with Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, who reflects on the historic demonstrations against the World Trade Organization in Seattle 1 year ago. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Florida's infamous butterfly ballot wasn't the only impediment facing voters in that state. For the disabled, especially the visually impaired, the situation was more difficult. According to Business Week magazine, not a single voting booth in the state is equipped with the touch screens and headphones found in electronic booths. The National Alliance of the Disabled stated that, once again, people with disabilities were ignored at polling places. The problems facing Americans with disabilities is a national issue. Only Rhode Island provides a voter's guide in Braille and tactile ballots. And despite the existence of a 1986 federal law mandating wheelchair access to polling places, more than 29,000 are still non-compliant. Ironically, during the 2000 campaign in which both candidates stressed their sensitivity to the disabled, neither Gore nor Bush opted to obtain telecommunications devices for the deaf, or TDD, to reach the hearing impaired. When asked, representatives from both campaigns admitted surprise that such devices existed. These problems could be resolved in the future if the federal government is willing to commit the resources. Electronic voting booths, which cost twice as much as regular booths, could be made available to districts that can't currently afford them. Some disabled voters are considering a lawsuit in the Florida Circuit Court alleging that the presidential election violated Title II of the Americans with Disabilities Act and Florida law, which requires all polling places to be fully accessible. Clearly, candidates who claim that every vote counts are going to have to make a greater effort to back up their rhetoric with some action. While the American public is fixated on the Florida courts as they decide the political fate of Al Gore and George W. Bush, another Florida case could disrupt the rights of women to seek abortion services. Dr. James Scott Pendergraft, an African-American abortion provider, is going on trial, charged with lying under oath and extortion, in relation to a lawsuit that Pendergraft filed against the town of Ocala, Florida, for failing to protect his health care clinic from anti-abortion protesters. According to The Nation magazine, Pendergraft, who runs five clinics in Florida, is very brash in his support of abortion rights. The doctor uses highway billboards to advertise his abortion services and talks openly about performing clinical abortions right up to the time limit of the 28th week of pregnancy. Further, Dr. Pendergraft upset many Ocala residents by raising a huge American flag on the day he opened his abortion clinic, in a town where an abortion clinic was burned down in 1989. The town of Ocala's case is based on a conference between Dr. Pendergraft and his lawyer, S. Leroy Lucas, a longtime pro-choice advocate, which was videotaped. During the session, Dr. Pendergraft threatened to bankrupt the town with lawsuits. The case is now being pursued by the U.S. Attorney's Office. The trial is set to start December 11th, and Dr. Pendergraft faces some stiff penalties, 30 years in jail, loss of his medical license, and a $1 million fine. Even if Dr. Pendergraft is found not guilty, negative signals will be sent out to struggling abortion providers. As The Nation magazine quips, don't even think about it. If the arsonists don't get you, litigation may. In August, Florida resident Bert Ammons pled guilty to smuggling 90 cylinders of ozone-destroying Freon, or CFC-12, into the United States, a clear violation of the Clean Air Act. Now Ammons faces a penalty of up to 5 years in jail and a $250,000 fine. Ammons is not alone in smuggling CFCs, or chlorofluorocarbon-producing gas. According to E! The Environmental magazine, there is a thriving black market in Freon and other CFC compounds. Freon can be purchased in China or Mexico for as little as $1 a pound and sold in the U.S. for $20 to $25 a pound. As a result, the U.S. border in Florida and Texas is a major access point for smuggling illegal CFCs into the U.S. The U.S. government banned the importation of freon and other ozone-destructive chemicals in 1996 in order to comply with the 1987 Montreal Protocol, phasing out the use of ozone-destroying chemicals. 173 nations have signed the Montreal Treaty. Over time, the treaty is expected to prevent massive depletion of ozone and, over the next 60 years, decrease the nearly 20 million cases of potential skin cancer. The ozone hole in Antarctica now covers 27 million miles, an area larger than North America. More alarming, U.S. industry is digging in to stop more environmental regulation of ozone-destroying chemicals. Specifically, strawberry and tomato growers and their allies in Congress have pushed back the date to 2005 for the final phase-out of methyl bromide, a farm pesticide linked to ozone depletion. This week's news summary was compiled by Rich Frazier and Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski. A day, 7 days a week, the corporate media have reported on every nuance of the battle for the presidency. Since the November 7th election, the print and electronic press have devoted exhaustive coverage to issues ranging from dimpled chads to the blizzard of lawsuits before Florida and federal courts. But while the media focuses on the fight for power between George W. Bush and Al Gore, another critical aspect of this extraordinary election has virtually gone unreported. Since Election Day, national and Florida civil rights groups have received hundreds of reports of voter intimidation and disenfranchisement related to race and ethnicity. Charges from African Americans, Haitian Americans, and Latino voters include claims of disparate treatment and the outright denial of their right to vote. Civil rights groups have responded by sending teams of lawyers to a number of Florida counties to investigate the charges and to evaluate the possible remedies. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Judith Brown, senior attorney with the Advancement Project, one of the groups conducting the investigation into voter discrimination. Attorney Brown reports on some of the specific allegations that the Republicans, Democrats, and press continue to ignore.
We got involved by helping the NAACP in its hearings that it held the Saturday after the election. And that was done in response to calls that the NAACP received from around the country, but in particular, the number of calls, the massive number of calls from the state of Florida. And we went down to investigate, to hear from the people, to see what was going on the ground, and found that massive numbers, thousands of African Americans have been disenfranchised on November 7th. And the kinds of allegations that we were seeing came in various forms. For example, in Miami, where there is a growing Haitian population, what happened there was that many of the Haitian Americans who cannot speak English and who speak Creole were not provided with assistance, and when they did have someone there to assist them in Creole, they were denied that opportunity. The other thing that we were finding is that people were showing up, African Americans were showing up to the polls with their voter registration card, with their identification, which is required in the state of Florida. They had voted in the primary, and all of a sudden their names were not on the voter list. And what would happen is that they would be told, well, your name is not on the list. You'll have to go into this line over here to, you know, another line to have your status verified. And inevitably what would happen is that that line would be so long and that people, you know, they would be calling into the Board of Supervisors to verify status. And those people would ultimately be denied the right to vote because they couldn't get the call through to the Board of Supervisors. The other types of allegations that we had were people who had shown up to their polling place, And the polling place was moved. A typical practice that happened in the era of Jim Crow, when, you know, what was done was, let's, you know, the power structure tried to do whatever they could to ensure that African Americans could not vote. And what would happen is that blacks would go to the polling place, and the polling place had been moved with no notice. And the same thing happened in particular in Broward County. There was one woman who went to a polling place that she had gone to. She had voted there in the past, several years in the past, went there for the primary election. November 7th, she shows up to that same high school, and it was not being used as a polling place. She didn't get notice. She went to four other places to figure out where she needed to vote. By the time she got to the fourth place, they told her, you're not on the list here either, and by the way, it's 7 o'clock, it's too late to go vote anyway. Then we have police intimidation allegations. Those allegations came from Hillsborough County and from Leon County, in which police officers had set up police checkpoints in African-American precincts near the polling places. In one instance, on a street that was a dead end leading to the polling place. And what they were doing is doing seatbelt checks, you know, checking your lights, checking, you know, all these things, you know, vehicle inspections and seatbelt checks and license checks. In one instance, I know in Leon County, the troopers, these were state troopers that were doing it in Leon County, they admitted that the troopers who set up this checkpoint had not gone through the proper procedures to set up a checkpoint, which is that you have to put notice in the newspaper so people know there's going to be a traffic jam. And number two, you have to set up a procedure so that you're going to, you know, stop every fifth car or every sixth car. And they had not done that, and they had not put in the paperwork to do that police checkpoint. You know, so we're looking at that issue and saying, well, what is that about? And it boils down to an attempt to intimidate voters, to make voters feel uncomfortable about exercising the franchise and making them think twice about going to cast that vote.
What are your options now? What can be done to either put in question the results of the election in Florida or to prevent reoccurrence of what happened there next time around?
Right. Well, what we're doing now is that we are continuing on in our investigation. And we are meeting with more and more witnesses, accumulating more and more evidence. The NAACP has committed to filing a lawsuit. As you know, they have already turned over what they had at the hearings over to the Justice Department and found that the Justice Department did not move quickly enough to vindicate the rights of African American voters. So at this point, we're continuing with our investigation, and a coalition of civil rights groups will be gathering to determine the next steps. We're looking at what the possible remedies could be. Those remedies could range from anything. And one of the things that I think we're definitely going to focus on is fixing the system for the next go-round, because we don't want to have people turning out to the polls and having this happen again. And we know that people now, you know, everyone should understand that every vote counts.
That was Judith Brown, senior attorney with the Advancement Project. Contact the project at area code 202-728-9557 or visit the website of the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights at www.civilrights.org. The Chilean military, led by General Augusto Pinochet, staged a bloody coup against the democratically elected socialist government of Salvador Allende in 1973. In the years since Pinochet stepped down from power and democratic rule was restored in Chile, human rights groups have demanded that the Clinton administration declassify documents revealing the U.S. role in the military overthrow. The 16,000 documents released on November 13th reveal the Nixon White House complicity in supporting the Chilean military's planning and execution of the coup, which murdered, kidnapped, and tortured thousands of political opponents. One transcript of a 1970 National Security Council meeting recorded Nixon and members of his cabinet discussing the need to, quote, hurt Allende and bring him down, unquote. The papers also include a cable from CIA operatives in Chile to Washington outlining a plan to foment a military takeover that they predicted would produce considerable carnage and a civil war. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Peter Kornbluh, senior analyst with the National Security Archive, the group which spearheaded the effort to declassify the Chile records. Kornbluh summarizes information contained in these documents.
After General Augusto Pinochet was arrested in London in October of 1998, we and other organizations and the families of many of General Pinochet's victims in the United States and abroad put great pressure on the Clinton administration to take a stand on his arrest. The United States was ominously silent, even though Pinochet had been involved in active international terrorism in Washington, and the United States was supposed to, you know, be leading the standard in the fight to advance human rights around the world. The United States said nothing, and we pressed in the administration. The administration finally decided that it would do a special declassification project that would allow documents that implicated Pinochet and human rights atrocities to be used in cases against him and his subordinates. It would serve the issue of the right to know of the American public what the United States had in its archives about General Pinochet's regime. Eventually, the declassification project covered the years 1968, 2 years before the Allende government, through the Allende government, and all the way through the 17 years of Pinochet's dictatorship. And so in the end, we've come out with 24,000 declassified documents over this last year and a half that we didn't have before, allowing us to really rethink the whole history of the U.S. involvement in Chile.
Peter Kornbluh, during the many years you've researched the U.S. involvement in the Chilean coup and the ensuing military dictatorship, you've sorted through thousands of documents and been confronted with the classification that wouldn't allow you to see many others. But I'm going to read a quote from the New York Times, and I'd like you to give us the truth test here. The Times said in a recent article, they said, a Senate investigation in 1975 concluded that the CIA was not directly involved in the 1973 coup that brought General Augusto Pinochet to power. And the new information apparently from this batch of documents provides no evidence to the contrary.
The key word there, of course, is directly, meaning kind of participating in the actual event itself. What we do know is that starting the fall of 1970, the CIA started working very closely with a number of Chilean generals trying to promote a coup right then, to the point of, as one CIA memo put it, creating chaos in order to create a coup climate. I just, a little earlier this evening, reading through these thousands of CIA cables, came across one where the CIA writes to headquarters from Chile, you know, you have asked us to provoke chaos in Chile, and we give you a plan, we give you a formula for chaos. And this is what the United States was trying to do. That was an operation kind of known as Track 2. The message was passed to the Chilean military, we will support you. That message continued to be passed to the military through the 3 years of the Allende government. On the actual day of the coup, we don't have documents that show that the CIA participated. We do have one new document, which is rather important. It's an intelligence report on Pinochet himself 1 year before the coup, where Pinochet has traveled to Panama to buy tanks, to buy U.S. Tanks, actually, for the Chilean military. Somebody who's traveling with him, another Chilean military official, turns out to be a CIA informant and is telling the CIA what Pinochet is saying. Pinochet is saying that he's, you know, preparing for a coup now. He thinks Allende has to go, either has to be forced to resign or be eliminated. In other words, murdered. And then the document continues that while they were in Panama, Pinochet's assistant, his aide, who is traveling with him, the CIA informant, is told by U.S. Army officials from the Southern Command in Panama that the United States will, quote, do whatever it takes, whatever is necessary, unquote, to support a coup. Now, here the message is being passed to the individual who would eventually lead this coup, Augusto Pinochet, that the United States was behind him. And I'm sure that he went into the coup knowing that, and of course, within hours of the coup taking place, the CIA was there saying, we are going to provide you support now. We're going to give you what you need. We're going to be working with you to help you consolidate, to improve your image, to set up your intelligence services, et cetera. And that is all basically in the documentary record now. Was the direct engagement, involvement in the coup? We don't have documents that show that. Was there a clear message sent to the Chilean military that the United States would support a coup, no matter how bloody? I think we have documents which show that, and certainly documents after the coup show the embrace from the Nixon administration in Washington and from the CIA on the ground.
That was Peter Kornbluh, senior analyst with the National Security Archive. Contact the archive by calling area code 202-994-7000 or visit their website at www.nsarchive.org. One year ago, on November 30th, an estimated 50,000 activists converged on Seattle, Washington, to protest the policies of the World Trade Organization. Before Seattle, most Americans knew little about the secretive trade organization and the profound effect it has on the lives of people here and abroad. During the actions known as N30, environmentalists, students, human rights, and labor activists engaged in legal and nonviolent civil disobedience to shut down the WTO meeting. The corporate media focused much of their coverage of Seattle on broken windows at Starbucks and police use of rubber bullets and tear gas against demonstrators, of whom over 600 were arrested. The powerful coalitions formed in Seattle have since spurred other impressive actions in the U.S. and around the world, advocating fair trade principles over corporate-driven free trade deregulation policies. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Michael Dolan, a key organizer in planning the Seattle actions, who serves as the deputy director with Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. Dolan reflects on the significance of last year's Seattle demonstrations and discusses the ongoing campaigns being waged by the growing global social justice movement.
Our task has been to educate people in all these different sectors and in all these different constituencies and communities about the true cost of corporate globalization in their lives and in their communities, and to organize them to take specific political action to frustrate the corporate agenda and to advance an agenda, a policy formulation that takes into account the legitimate expectations of working families and of the environment in an increasingly globalized economy. Seattle came along early 1999. We learned that the World Trade Organization was going to have its third ministerial meeting in Seattle, Washington. I went out there right away to start to organize on the ground to organize a fair trade welcome, a mobilization against corporate globalization. And the mainstream media and many, many people in this country, policy and media elites, sort of found out about our critique, which had been forming, and our coalition, which had been forming and growing over the years when we came out, you know, in force, as you say, in Seattle. And I just have to say that it was a wonderful thing, a wonderful time. Many of your listeners, I hope, were there. I hope that they avoided the tear gas and avoided jail, but in many situations it was unavoidable, that crazy week in Seattle a year ago. The result is really something of a paradigm shift, I think, in this country and internationally, that now the fair trade movement, as distinguished from the free trade agenda, can no longer be ignored. And when the Congress reconvenes in the 107th Congress in January, I think we will see the fruit of this organizing that's going on and this coalition building that's going on, and we will be able to further resist the corporate agenda, as well as to begin to articulate the progressive alternatives that all those constituencies, I think, share.
From the point of view of an organizer, it certainly is better to be on the offensive than the defensive. Where do you think things are at now? Because, as you said, these multinational corporations and the allied governments they work with are proposing treaty after treaty and global trade law after global trade law, which puts non-governmental organizations and the average citizen around the world who doesn't want to harmonize, as has often been said, in a race to the bottom,
right,
but want something different. Do you see things shifting since Seattle that places groups organizing for fair trade policies in more of an advantageous position there?
Well, I mean, the short answer, of course, is yes, but with this, I think, proviso, we do have one big defensive battle that is brewing now that we still have to fight, and that is, of course, the expansion of NAFTA throughout the hemisphere. Negotiations have been underway among the trade ministries, including our own United States Trade Representative's office, ever since NAFTA, to create something called the Free Trade Area of the Americas, the FTAA. We call it NAFTA for the Americas, NAFTA for the hemisphere, and those negotiations are fairly mature. They've been talking for a number of years now, and in Quebec City, this upcoming April, the heads of state and the corporate lobby, which has been influencing these negotiations, will be meeting in Quebec City, in Quebec, in Canada, and a large Seattle-like coalition and mobilization is underway to frustrate that agenda. But the good news is, and this is in direct reply to your inquiry, we now are able to better articulate the progressive alternative vision to the free trade model. A lot of our allies throughout the hemisphere, the CUT, the labor movement in Chile and Brazil, as well as sustainable environmental groups throughout the hemisphere, many veterans of NAFTA and the MAI, and indeed, of course, many veterans of the WTO fight, have come together in different fora and different opportunities to begin to describe this, we're calling it sort of a hemispheric social agreement that will be describe the kinds of things like indigenous people's rights, sustainable development. The global warming issue, obviously, is going to be part of that. And to be able to say to the press and to the policy elites, when they say, we know what you're against, tell us what you're for, we can begin to articulate that so public opinion inevitably will turn our way because, frankly, the values which our coalition presents in this debate are the values that are shared by the majority of people in all democracies.
That was Michael Dolan, Deputy Director with Public Citizen's Global Trade Watch. Contact Public Citizen by calling area code 202-546-4996 or visit their website at www.tradewatch.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756, or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Rich Frazier, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.